bringing the attention to the Pachubana Dhamma here and now. In the sense of opening, relaxed, opening receptivity. So seeing meditation then in terms of instead of something you have to do, which can create this sense of I've got to get something I don't have, and then we think I've got to meditate in order to get rid of stress, or this way of thinking can be counterproductive and becomes another thing we have to do. So, like Lungpa Cha's description of a meditation as holiday for the heart, resting the mind, Pakpon Tang Jitjai, that's the Thai. So, this is Lungpa Cha's definition of meditation. These are worth considering, you know, contemplating, and how we hold meditation or practice is to see whether this arouses this kind of compulsive striving tendency, which is so common in the Western world, kind of we're programmed into achieving goals. So our cultural conditioning is very kind of goal-oriented, of attaining, getting rid of and attaining. So this is where like opening to the way it is, you're beginning to just notice that, be aware of these tendencies, compulsive tendencies or obsessive tendencies. Feeling there's something you've got to do, you've got to get. You've got to get rid of anger, get rid of bad thoughts. And so then this is putting yourself into that position of the bhuto, the knowing position, of being aware, open, receptive to this habit, because this is a habit tendency, this is an ultimate reality. You know, this is not a refuge to attach to. Now, speaking from experience, because I certainly understand the problem, being having that problem myself, that it's not theory, but just pointing, as aware of this compulsiveness of thought, and this kind of inner feeling of something I've got to do, something lacking, something I've got to get that I don't have. It's a kind of feeling that drives one, pushes one around, or I've got to get rid of things, there's certain weaknesses or bad habits that I've got to get rid of, I've got to eradicate them, extirpate them, resonate them, kill them off. So that's these two extremes, indulgence and suppression, are in the Tamajaka Pavatana Sutta, Gama Sukalikanu Yoka Atakina Matanu Yoka. Like looking for happiness is always, you know, in the world, seeking happiness is our goal in the world. Or seeking to annihilate what we don't like, to control, get rid of, deny, suppress. So happiness is a goal. I mean, we have happiness, but as a goal, it's unsatisfying. It's momentary. It's not, you can't sustain it for very long. So that means one's always looking for something, you know, always losing it and having to try to find it again. So once you've achieved happiness, you can't keep it. So then your life is spent seeking, trying to get it back or get more. So this is the problem of the conditioned attachment to the conditioned realm. The Sankata Dhamma. These Pali words, Sankata is like conditioned. Asankata is unconditioned. So there's just a lesson in Pali grammar there. The R sound is a negative. And Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, when he was alive in his monastery, some of you have been there, to Suan Mok in Suratani province, he's always presenting kind of enigmatic Pali words to reflect upon. And the last one he came up with is Atamiyata. That's a very interesting word, and it means atam is not that, you know, ah is a negation, not that. Maya, which is created or compounded or concocted state of being, da always means a kind of state of being. So, not that concocted state of being. That's a negation, isn't it? It points to this, it's not that, it's not this thought. This thoughts are compounded, aren't they? We concoct thinking, we create it. Or feeling, you know, or emotion. The body, it's a creation, it comes and goes. This is a word, but it's for reflection, for contemplation, not that Maya, Maya is defined as illusion. So when we live in a world of illusions, and this is a concocted state, isn't it? We create a world to live in. So I can create my own world, you know, how my view, my opinion, my feelings, where I as a person am the center, my sensitivity, all this, and this my is a concocted sense of self. I see myself through compounding things. Through my personality becomes my center. So I'm giving this personality, empowering it, you know, to live life. And then it becomes, it's all frustrated, ambitious, angry, greedy, confused, obsessed, compulsive. Neurotic, mad, you know, so forth. So that this is the compounding of this moment. So it's interesting, just the grammar, not that. It's a pointing at, it's not a kind of, what do you say, an abstraction. Pointing to some abstract definition of the unconditioned, but it's more like a direct pointing. And say, not that, it's not this body, not that thought or feeling, emotional power. So when you reflect in this way, you know, then you're using this sati sampajanya, which is not personal. It's not a part of one's personality. It's functional. It's here and now. It's natural. What isn't concocted? What is it at this moment? You're not making up. When I start thinking about myself, my feelings and my views and opinions and my life and my worth and all that, then I'm creating something. All kinds of things about me as a person, as a human being, as a monk, and so forth, and then it becomes, it's a concoction of my mind, isn't it? I create that. And yeah, I can be totally committed, you know, if I'm not aware, I can be totally committed to myself, my view, the way I think. So you get fanatics, don't you? Religious fanatics or political fanatics who are committed to their own views. Racist views or political views or religious views. Kill the infidels or burn the heretics kind of views. These are concoctions of the mind. Because when you don't create anything in the present, when you just trust in awareness, you know, you're reaching that axis mundi. You're beginning to rest in that natural place of being, in that atamyata, that which you're not creating, compounding. So in this, it's natural, in English words, it's a natural state, not created. This is important to reflect upon, you know, like, refined concentration depends on conditions, supporting on refined conditions. Atamyata isn't seeking special conditions, because it doesn't depend. It's not. It's creation. It's manifestation. It's not. It doesn't manifest. It isn't something that you can make, you know, by refining conditions, but something you recognize. So then there's Nibbana. You know, in Thailand, the Lumpur Cha Puttadasa always asked about what is Nibbana. He said, the reality of non-attachment. Reality of non-attachment. It's not like where sometimes the word itself, because it's a rather beautiful word in its own right, sounds, you know, sublime. And can be interpreted as some kind of high heavenly state. But in terms of scriptural use, and it's the reality, the realization of non-attachment. So that's why in Paticca-samuppada, or dependent origination, you're really studying attachment before you can realize non-attachment, you have to know what attachment is. You know, again, one can kind of live in a spacey world of I shouldn't be attached to anything as a kind of wish. But that's not it. It's not going around trying to pretend you're not attached to anything. It's, you know, in Paticca Samuppada, you're really observing the process that leads to attachment, ignorance, that influences sankhara, isn't it? Mental formations. It has its effect on consciousness, and which takes us to when desire arises, which leads to desire and attachment. So this upadana or clinging attachment, you know, is something to really reflect on. Not just say you shouldn't be, make some kind of statement about how you shouldn't be attached, because that's not it. It's not a matter of believing and then judging oneself from an ideal of non-attachment, but recognizing attachment. So then, once you recognize the problem, you can let go. You can't let go of something that's theoretical or idealistic. So this is very practical then. So if I recognize upadana in myself, you know, when I'm obsessed with that, if I'm upset, you know, the dukkha, if you know, I feel personally threatened or whatever, or if I feel overwhelmed or upset or angry or whatever, I go to that place where I'm suffering. So that's putting us back into the paradigm of the Noble Truths, attachment to desire. Take an interest in attachment, you know, study it, you know, admit it. You know, I found a lot of attachments around my sense of my personality, my ego. You know, not wanting to look bad, feeling threatened by somebody, not wanting to lose face, not wanting, you know, fearing somebody else might harm me or humiliate me. All kinds of fears around this. It's, because the ego, you know, the attachment to this sense of a self as a person. Wanting to be right, isn't it? The ego, you know, I'm right, my view is right. And insisting on being right. The obsession about I have to be right all the time. And so then if you don't agree with me, then you're wrong. And then the anxiety about maybe you're right and I'm not, and then the ego goes into a kind of problem there of doubt and worry. Things like this is the conceit, arrogance, the ego, in all its, you know, egos aren't necessarily bad. They can be quite pleasant, good too, so, but they're created. You know, so it's not, so that when we attach to those compounded creations, concoctions, then we're, you know, then the result is this dukkha, because there's something missing. It's true, there is something missing, some lack. So that's why this going back to the center, to the axis mundi, to the still point of the turning wheel, to the unshakable spot of awareness. So you see, this, the escape from samsara is always here and now. It's this is not something, you know, that you have to attain. It's a realization. So in realizing nibbana is realizing the peace that comes from non-attachment. You know, if you know what attachment is, not through definition but through observing your own witnessing to attachment and then the result of attachment, then there is a natural movement of letting go. You know, one doesn't hold on to pain if there's a way of letting go of it. Or to, you know, like desire is synonymous to fire, you don't burn yourself intentionally anymore. No need to suffer for no reason once you realize the causes. So then, non-suffering is the Eightfold Path. You know, just putting it in simpler, Eightfold sounds a bit complicated, but non-suffering, the way of non-suffering, then is here and now, isn't it? It's not, you know, something you have to attain, the Eightfold Path, but these Four Noble Truths are pointing always to this present moment. The path is right now. It's not something you will get through doing a lot of meditation in the future. It's being to trust in that reality of knowing, of being aware. Atamayata, not that made up thing, not that creation, not that concoction. So anatta also, you know, you can say anattata, the state of not that self, no self. Atta is self, and anatta is no self. Da is state of being. So anattata is a state of no self. So then you know your awareness is then tuning in. You're kind of tuning into reality rather than you know, making it up. Reality is now, it's not something, you know, you don't create reality. So in the third noble truth, the realization. Realization of cessation. When conditions cease, when the self ceases, you realize, well, this is it. This is real. Yeah, this. You know, so it's a state of attentiveness rather than of discovering some condition that you identify with. There's nothing to identify, is it? In cessation, you don't become someone who's realized cessation. It's a recognition. This is it. No self. And then the path, Eightfold Path, the Samaditti, of course, right view. You have the right, you see things in the right way now. Or sometimes Sama is the word Samaditti, Sama is usually translated as right, but some people have even used perfect view. What is a perfect view? And is it a thought, some kind of, can you make a is Samaditti some kind of conception? Or is it an understanding, a profound understanding, intuitive understanding of reality? Because it's very clear the Buddha didn't leave a lot of doctrines to bind ourselves to, you know, the basis is bases for thinking and compounding upon. And then there's always, in the Theravada school, it was always like, every time you try to grasp some kind of, make some dogmatic statement out of Buddhism, it doesn't work very well. As you notice, the Buddha pointed to suffering, not to a metaphysical thing. The reality of the deathless is realized not through defining it, but pointing. So it's a kind of opposite of other religious approaches where the Buddha points to a kind of ordinary common human experience of suffering. Through exploring, investigating, we realize the deathless, the unconditioned. So it remains in that state of negation, unconditioned. I don't know if deathless is a negation. Immortal. Uncompounded, uncreated. And you notice how negation works on your mind. You know, this is grammar, but when you negate something, there is a kind of sense of, you know, it can be annihilation or it can be, in terms of reflection, it's liberation. Because when we try to bind ourselves, usually positively, with I am the ultimate truth, or I am this or that, or then it easily builds into concocting something again. So in the kind of via negativa approach, you know, because this is how language works, how it affects consciousness. they recognize the Buddhist teachings are always pointing at the here and now, at reality. They're not theoretical philosophical speculations. So this is where you're encouraged to explore this. And like when you become samanas, you know, you monks and nuns, and that you're kind of given this imprimatur to use the system fully. You know, it's kind of giving the blessings of the Sangha to use the teaching, the Dhamma Vinaya. It's agreed on by the Sangha, you know, with the blessing of the Sangha. So it has a lot of power, you know, monastic forms. It's not to become Buddhist monk or Buddhist nun that's not the point. Or to kind of browbeat you into conformity and institutionalize you in a monastic system. This is kind of given the right and the encouragement to use the convention fully for awareness, not for attachment. And the problem lies, of course, in how we use the conventions. So, at first we tend to, with what we know from the conditioning of our mind, until we've had these insights, had this insight, then we do operate from oftentimes, the monastic identity, and we create, it becomes part of our ego. So if one doesn't really investigate the Four Noble Truths, then, one can use the system, to create more identities, more delusions. So this is where, it's up to each one. One can't force someone to be undeluded. Not. Even though, I can say, don't be deluded and all that. tell you, how the actual awakening is something only you can do yourself. And if I keep frightening you, I keep shouting at you, don't be deluded. Be mindful, and then that's true. I'm telling you something true and right, but maybe I'm doing it in a way that it just frightens you. Every time you see me, here comes that old guy, he's going to tell me not to be deluded anymore. it's not. If I come across as a real heavy, a authoritarian teacher, then that, just that energy of me telling you can be quite an obstruction. This is where it's, this is where the encouragement is to really recognize, like waking up, attention, mindfulness, something you can recognize in yourself. You can realize it yourself. You don't need me to tell you. And to take that, build that confidence in your awareness rather than saying, you know, putting all your confidence in me because I'm your teacher, so I know what you need. That tends to put the onus back onto somebody else outside yourself. See, so it's learning to trust in awareness. To recognize it, to treasure it. It's the gate to the deathless. It's the way out. You know, it's something. There is a way out of this concocted realm we're living in, this realm of dukkha. There is a way out of it, which is not a destructive way. We're not destroying the world or condemning it. We're knowing. You know, we're liberating ourselves not by rejecting it, but by understanding it, knowing it. So it's not a annihilationist teaching at all. It's not like Armageddon or destroying conditioned phenomena because, you know, we see it as deluding, killing the witches, burning the witches, killing the infidels. It's not that kind of, that's an annihilationist attitude. The United States, getting rid of the terrorists, annihilating all the terrorists, the focuses of evil. It's very frightening, actually. Now, evil is, you know, once you don't destroy it, you know it. You know, so like anger, hatred, fears and things are to be understood, you know, then they're no longer, you know, we have to learn from that, not by following those conditions, but by recognizing them. So anger, hatred, all that is like this, you know, when the conditions are present, then this is what I'm feeling. So, but this is not my refuge anymore. It's an opportunity. It's an occasion for understanding. Because this realm is like this, you know. It's irritating. There's so many. It's good and bad. Light and dark, it's beautiful and ugly, it's all these things, all the conditioned phenomena is dualistic. You know, so if you have one, you have the other. If you have light, you have dark, and on like this. So if you have right, you have wrong, good and evil. They're a pair, you know, they go together. Notice that this is just the way it is, because you know these concepts, dualistic thinking and concepts, is a divisive function of the mind. It's discriminative. You know, when you think, you're dividing things. If I'm thinking me, then that makes me very separate from you. I'm clinging to the fact of me, then I feel, you know, you as something very separate. Or if I'm attached to I'm right and you don't agree, then you're wrong. You know, so there's a division there. God is on my side and not, and you're on the side of the devil. So this is because this limitation of thinking, thoughts, you know, are like that. They're not, it's not, you can't liberate yourself through thinking. So in the awareness, you know, is the gate to the deathless. Atamyata. Now, in terms of skillful use of thought, I'm not saying one shouldn't think anymore. I think it's part of our life. It's something that can be used skillfully. But as an attachment, like when we create, you know, when we create worlds, concoct ourselves, it's through thinking. Remembering, attachment to memories, views, assumptions we have about ourselves. And so then I become this person. If you stop thinking, you recognize or realize the gap between thoughts before thought arises. Thought is always concocted, isn't it? It comes and goes. It's not absolute. It's obviously very, you know, it's a function of the mind. And yet we can be so bound into thinking that we have no perspective on it. You know, so one has this think, think, think problem. And then the obsessions around oneself. So then this awareness transcends thinking. You know, you're really recognizing this awareness and thinking as an object then, rather than the subject. So the sati sampajanya, satipanya, these words are pointing at that reality. Bhutto, pointing at this reality. So then, say, in developing the path, the simplification helps. Simplify your lives. You know, so, you know, try to, you know, we can, you know, the life, modern life can be, you know, people complain about stress all the time. They feel stressed. Because their life is very speedy now. There's a, you know, kind of out of touch with natural rhythms. We can live in completely artificial environments now. You know, so we are quite comfortably in everything but to sustain this, it takes a lot of work and makes our lives complicated. Because even though we're not bound to just washing the clothes in the river anymore, we occupy ourselves with other things, since we don't have to spend that much time doing the laundry, we can do all kinds of other things. That are artificial. You know, at least when you're washing your clothes in the river, there's something quite, you know, it can be done very mindfully. It's quite a natural thing to be doing. But then, I don't have time to do that anymore. I need an electric washer and dryer, and so I can have more time on the computer. Something's lost again, isn't it? Simplification. Monasticism is meant to be simplifying one's lifestyle, the way one lives. Now this is moving towards simplicity rather than complexity, because we're already so complicated. We're very like a sticky web of complications. One's mind. My mind used to be like, I used to define it as a sticky web of complications. I just see everything stuck to it. So then, with this simplicity, going to the one or the ekagata, then is in this ability to recognize here and now. It's very simple, isn't it? It's not a complicated, highly technical thing, that the Buddha's pointing at. But it is, it's subtle. And our minds, the more complicated, the more we're lost in complications, and we have no subtlety. We can't see anymore because the mind is continually occupied with more and more thoughts and complicated views and opinions, and desires and habits. So for me now, just like listening, this is my practice, and relaxing. Opening, this sense of receiving life. Welcoming. Because of my personal tendency is to resist, try to get rid of things. So I to counterbalance that tendency is to open or welcome. Like when complicated things come my way, problems in the Sangha and so forth, my first reaction, habitual reaction is, oh no, not another problem, oh my God. Why is it always somebody causing a problem? Jesus. I mean, I'm sorry. That's the personality. I don't want any problems. I just want simple life and don't want any problems in anything. And why do people always have to make life difficult and be so stubborn and then complain like that? And that's my personality easily moves into that one, you see. So then, because of that, then I develop this upaya of welcoming, seeing it as an opportunity rather than as, oh, just another problem, another difficult thing to deal with that I don't want, seeing it as opportunity. Because it is, the movement of life is, if we're open to it, we keep learning. If we're trying to, I just want a simple life and no problem, then we kind of whinge our way through life and always trying to, every time life gets a bit complicated or stressful, we complain and want to go somewhere else and so forth. So just noticing, because I tend to do this, then the upaya I create is this welcome. And just thinking, what is welcoming? Something I don't want. No, I don't want any problems on a personal level. So I use the welcome, you know, and I kind of look at it in a different way, try to change the perspective from just this, I don't want this, to welcome, you know, there's something to learn from. So I found this helpful, skillful means of receiving what I don't want personally. So just note, you know, this is how you're creating skillful means or upayas according to, you know, how you know yourself. What kind of obsessions or blind spots do you have? And you're the one that knows, really. You have to admit it and see it. It's like this. Then the skillful means, how to deal with it. You know, if I'm saying, oh no, I don't want any, then I realize this is not skillful, just operating from, I don't want to be bothered with anything difficult, to welcoming. And then see what happens, you know, see what is the result of that. Well, I find the result is, you know, it reminds me, I'm with the Dhamma. I'm not caught in this. It's a very unpleasant mental state to be attached to. It's, oh no, I don't want this. And why do people have to be so different? And that kind of thing. This is not a mental state that I enjoy. You know, it's not one I want to cultivate. But it is a habit of the mind. Because if I get lost in that, then, you know, it multiplies. It takes me over. So this is where, you know, seeing the pain, the suffering from just being attached and lost in this habit of whinging and complaining, to welcoming. Then I find I can rise up to things. You know, if there's something in me that's quite, you know, solid and strong and willing to take life on and not just complain and whine when it isn't going the way I want it to. And then I think, I like that side of me. That kind of noble, brave side. I like that. But the whinging, oh no, I can't stand it too much. this is not what I want to be, you know. This is not a state of mind I want to hold to. Because when I really look at it, it's unpleasant, isn't it? It's really misery to be lost in that kind of thinking. But it's not a kind of brave heart type of thing I'm asking you to do, but, you know, skillful means the way. But it does have this sense of being, you know, of being an individual who is willing to take life and learn from it, rather than someone who's trying to get away from everything because it's too much to bear. And other morning's reflection about suicide bombers. I had some discussion about this. What I meant, I wasn't condoning that. Because, you know, you're using suicide as a way of harming others, which I find morally unacceptable. You know, so if I'm doing something, killing myself in order to kill other innocent people, then I don't find that inspiring at all. But what I was pointing to is that that sacrificing oneself for a cause, there's something quite inspiring about that. Like sacrificing your life for your brother or your family or something, you know, is a self-sacrifice in which you're not sacrificing yourself to harm others, but to save others. So I imagine that suicide bombers, as convoluted as their thinking must be, there is a sense of, it's for a cause of, of the Palestinian people or things like this. So it's not just a malicious desire to harm innocent people or some demonic force, but it can be deluded. It's deluded, yes, but it's also probably, with most of them, a sense of self-sacrifice. So when people are oppressed, like Palestinians tend to be, then they tend to use any means to fight back. And since they're not wealthy and powerful, they use themselves. I mean, it's pathetic, isn't it? It's very sad to see that's the only way they can protest is by suicide. That's very sad, really. Because when you're facing, an oppressive force that is much more powerful and advanced than you are, then what do you do? So this is where, modern life is, you see the problems of the world very much about the inequalities of the wealthy and the poor now. This is a reflection. This isn't Ajahn Sumedho's political views. But, you see that the terrorist movement, isn't it? There's a tremendous inequality of wealth. And, the Western world, we're bound and determined to see that we keep ours and increase it at the expense of the other. So, it's not, this is where we need to look at and what that does. It just creates resentment, anger, and envy and desire, So you find more and more economic refugees, people trying to go into wealthy countries because wealth is attractive. They want some of it too. And that's natural to, wealth is attracts. So, and yet we've got to keep them out, kind of feeling. Build the walls and let, keep the vulgar hordes away. So this is the dualistic structure again, of thinking and me and you, where in terms of Dhamma, we recognize the common bond of dukkha that we all share with the poor, the rich. It's not we're not in a position of condemning the West or the wealthy or that, but pointing the causes of suffering are due to what? Islamic terrorists? Are they the target? Are they what we can put all our blame on? Or is it even in the way we think about ourselves? Aren't we all involved in this in some way? Of course, this is probably dangerous, you know, at a time where they probably think of me as a terrorist. Even suggesting that maybe, one bringing into consciousness this problem where with human beings, isn't it? There's always balancing. Nature's always seeking a balance. And there's so many human beings on the planet now, more than there ever has been in any known time, you know. The planet is chock-a-block with humanity. So, how are we going to live with each other, is the question. How are we going to survive and share the wealth and the necessities, you know, with so many humans? And then there's control, you know, build up big defense systems, dominate, be, you know, use our power to protect ourselves. There's the kind of ignorant reaction of superpowers, isn't it? Use our power to protect ourselves. Keep them out. Keep them away. Don't let them in. Or try to make them, you know, follow us, you know, browbeat them into conformity. So, this is, you know, this is ignorance, and understandable, you know, understand that reaction. But now, say, we're in this state of reflecting on the way things are, and the causes of suffering, and that so we're, you know, we can develop wisdom, and it's very much needed at this time, wisdom. There isn't, you don't see it operating in any active way in the international scene or socially. The wisdom is not a very apparent. Maybe few individuals at best. So in terms of, you know, what we can offer as individuals is what we're doing now, isn't it? Opening, really getting to the cause, the root causes of suffering, and realizing the way of non-suffering in our own conscious experience of life. So that this awakening of individuals is like this retreat, this Buddhist teaching, is for that. It's to awaken. Because this is part of our humanity. We have this potential. We don't have to be just blind followers in the vulgar herd. So I also appreciate what you are doing yourself, your own efforts in this direction. You know, there's something to recognize in yourself is something, you know, what brings you here and interests you and inspires you and keeps you here. What is it that you have this kind of inclination. Say, this is something to treasure in yourself. It's not just, oh, I'm tired of the world, I want to get out of it, I just can't stand it anymore. Even though one can entertain such thoughts, but is that really, you know, maybe that might be some kind of reaction you might have at times, but recognize that this being human, this humanity that we share, has this potential, and we all sense it or intuit it in a way, the potential and the possibility for this liberation. When you think about it on a conditioned plane of self, then it seems very remote. So that's why you can't believe it. You know, you can't believe your personal reactions or habits, because they're conditions that have been created out of ignorance of the Dhamma. So this is where now you're opening to the reality, to Dhamma. Trust that, and then the wisdom flows through these forms. You know, wisdom is through Dhamma, not through personal attainments or achievements. And then the more humanity, the more human individuals develop wisdom, that potential increases for the rest. Somebody asked me once, do you believe there are arahants in the Himalayas, like the theosophists say, or that there are enlightened beings living in remote places and saints? And you know, the cynical mind wants to, that's all just what I think. Well, I hope so, because if there weren't, the world would probably be a lot worse off than it is. That if there were no enlightened beings, no clear-minded individuals left on the planet, it would probably be much worse. So you know, it's not. But then this is waiting for, you know, worshipping arahants, unknown arahants in the Himalayas. It's all right, you know, but it's not, it won't be liberating for you. It's certainly better than worshipping neo-Nazis or anything like that. But recognize that when we want to do something to help the world, this is what we're doing now is very significant. It's an offering, and because you're getting to the root, the very basis of where ignorance starts. It's not just a idealistic, let's share the wealth with the poor, but it's getting beyond the sense of separation, where we care, you know, we have a sense of concern and interest in helping on that level of just material, you know, sharing the material wealth so that people have, you know, enough to live on. And there isn't this, you know, incredible gap, which is going to, you know, as long as that gap remains, it's always going to be, you know, the rich always have to build walls around themselves to survive. You have to build a castle, a fortress, to protect your wealth, because that's creating an imbalance.